This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
That in order to understand the extent to which Yitzchok, so to say, fell for Esav, one can't merely analyze it with normal principles of logic, but this was certainly something which the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted played out in that particular way, only by Yaakov, only by Yitzchok falling for Esav, would the whole episode of the unusual way of the acquisition of the brochus to Yaakov have occurred. And it seems that for some reason the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted the brochus to be achieved through this apparently sly method. One of the reasons perhaps we'll have an opportunity to touch on later on. Nevertheless, we need to have some kind of appreciation of what seems to be an absurd story. A man as wicked as Esau, a man as destructive as Esau, to be able to fool a man as perceptive, as great, as insightful as Yitzchok. There has to be some kind of rational understanding to it as to what happened. And although the Tzipurnu says that it doesn't mean, Chas v'Sholem, that Yitzchok liked Esav and not Yaakov, it merely is discussing the contrast that whereas Rivka only liked Yaakov, Yitzchok liked them both. Says the Tzipurnu, Vayehav Yitzchok is Esav, and Yitzchok loved Esav, Gam is Esav. That means he loved even Esav. Even though he knew without any question that Esav was no comparison to Yitzchok, to Yaakov, in matters of shlemus, of perfection, nevertheless he saw potential in Esav and he loved him for it. But Rivka loved only Yaakov. That's what the Torah means. Not that Yitzchok loved Esav and Rivka loved Yaakov. Yitzchok loved them both, and Rivka loved only Yaakov. Because she realized that Esav was a real baddie. She saw how bad he really was, and she had no time for him at all. But nevertheless, one has to understand also how it is that Yitzchok appears to have fallen for him. And the Torah gives us the reason which makes it even more difficult to understand, and says, Vayehav Yitzchak es Esav, and Yitzchok loved Esav. Why? The Torah gives us the reason. Ki tayud b'fiv, because the food which Esav had hunted was in the mouth of Yitzchok. The Targum Unculus translates that. Are mitzide hava ochil. Because Yitzchok ate from the tzayid, from the game of Esav. The Targum Yonason translates it differently and says, because Esav arumili ram yusei befume. Because there were words of hunting in the mouth of Esav. In other words, when it says, for there was game in his mouth, the question is, in whose mouth? Unculus says, in Yitzchok's mouth, and it means game literally. The Targum Yonason says it is in Esav's mouth, and it means game metaphorically. The art of cunning, the art of hunting was in the mouth of Esav, and with that he was able to fool his father. Both of them very difficult. However skillful Esav was in the art of deceit and conmanship, that Yitzchok of all people should have fallen for it. And the other interpretation, Unculus, is even more difficult, that because he got a good meal from Esav, that's why he became blind to Esav's wickedness. Also peculiar and strange. I've spoken several times about the differences in the various of the five senses with which the human being operates. But my father pointed out to me when he was here that it's a Mefurish Rabbeinu Yonah. That Rabbeinu Yonah, in the beginning of Parshas Yisro, goes through the five senses with an interesting thesis. His thesis is that they vary in degree of spirituality, that they're not all equal. The five senses, some are more physical than others, and others are more spiritual. And how does one determine which is the more physical and which is the more spiritual? He starts off with the first one as being touch, the sense of feel. And its purpose primarily, says Rabbeinu Yonah, is to protect a person from danger, from damage. You should be able to feel around, otherwise you could damage your body without knowing it. Through one's ability to feel and to touch and to feel limitations, one knows one's environment and one does not come to harm. And you learn to distinguish heat and cold this way. It's a very important sense, but it's important primarily for the purpose of self-protection. It has no great spiritual elevated purpose. Its purpose primarily is one of protection. V'hachush hazeh yuchash b'negoya shetachush tehi b'shetach haguf acher chutz b'imena. And this sense functions only when the sensitive area, that's the body, comes into physical contact with the body which is to be sensed. There has to be absolute physical contact, otherwise the sense doesn't operate. You cannot feel something which you're not touching. And that shows that it's the most physical of all the senses. It needs absolute physical contact. That's how Rabbeinu Yonah treats the chush ha-mishush, the primary, the most primitive of the senses, the sense of touch. V'achush ha-sheni, the second one, hu motzui b'chelik miyuchad miguf ha-odom. Already we see it becoming more sophisticated, says the Rabbeinu Yonah, because the next sense has a specific organ. It's not all over the body. The sense of touch is all over the body. The next sense has a specific organ, and that's the tongue. He's talking about the sense of taste. And the sense of taste, there is a little bit more absorption. And it's not just a matter of coming into contact. Here already, a part of the tasted object needs to be dissolved in the saliva and absorbed into the taste buds. So there still has to be physical contact, but it's more sophisticated contact before the human being can really enjoy the taste. Touch is immediate. You touch something, you feel it immediately. Nothing has to happen. There just has to be physical contact. But when it comes to taste, it's a specific part of the body, and the organ of taste has to operate in a particular way to achieve the taste. The third one is smell. That too has a specific organ used to achieve it. That's the nose. And here too, there is a level that is some degree of physical contact, but much less. Yeah, molecules of the object which is smelt have to rise into the air and mix in the air and be drawn into the body through the nose when one breathes, and then through the contact of these molecules. But now it's only tiny molecules which are leaving. It's much finer. No longer is there the same sense of contact as there, this primitive contact that there has to be with a sense of touch, or the slightly less primitive contact that there is with a sense of taste. Now there is already a more sophisticated contact, the sense of smell, where invisible particles, where invisible molecules, tiny minute particles, enter the nose, and there through the absorption of the air one is able to, the inhaling of the air one is able to smell them. And here the purpose is also that we're able to distinguish healthy foods from unhealthy foods, but apart from that, it also makes one feel good. It's also a self-preservation thing. It's for one's physical well-being. But one can achieve physical well-being by pleasant smells, by beautiful smells. There's an aesthetic sense.
And the fourth one,
the fourth one is the power of vision. This is more sophisticated. More purposeful than the three others we've mentioned so far.
Ki zeachush, this sense, ein tzorich shiyafkish boi shum guf mehamuchoshim.
Here there need not be any physical contact whatever before the sensor and that which is being sensed. Whereas in touch there has to be physical contact, and in taste there has to be physical contact, and even in smell there has to be physical contact between the molecules and the nerve endings in the nose. When it comes to vision, there does not have to be any physical contact at all between that which is being perceived and that and he who is perceiving.
Elo bahaboto achas mirochik, you can give one glance from the distance. Yuchal lirus dvorim rabbi mishunim ze mizeh,
one can see and distinguish different things one from the other. Amazing thing is that my father mentioned it at the Motzei Shabbos that he was here. The stars, you're looking at light years of distance. I was looking at distance which it's really beyond the human mind to fully absorb and integrate. At hundreds of light years, that if we could travel at the speed of light, it would take us hundreds and sometimes thousands of years to reach. And we can stand here, and with a little sensory organ called the eye, we can not only see the stars, but we can distinguish between different stars and different colors, even of the stars. The bluer stars and the redder stars and the different colors can be perceived with the naked eye. Distances like that, it's something totally unbelievable. That's the chush harius, that one can use that power of perception, one can use that sense, even from an enormous distance. And therefore, it is far more spiritual, far more choice than any of the others, which are more primitive senses. However, there is a limitation when it comes to vision too. There must be no chatzitza, there must be no mechitza. Nothing must interrupt the line of vision. You can even be looking, you can look at something very far, you can look at a star that is hundreds of light years away and you can see it. But you might be looking at a person who is 1 meter away, and if there's a wall between you and him, you won't see him. If there's even just a curtain between you and him, you won't be able to see him. So this enormous power of the eye to perceive with accuracy and discernment hundreds of light years away needs one requirement in order to function. It needs two requirements. The one requirement that it needs is clear line of vision. There may be nothing in between. The second requirement, says the Rabbeinu Yonah, is it also has to have an external source of energy. There must be a source of light. The eye cannot operate without a source of light. So while it is highly sophisticated, while the eye is highly sophisticated, and the power of vision is a very elevated sense, it is a sense that is governed by two serious limitations. It cannot operate without light, and it cannot operate if there is an interruption, a chatzitza between in the line of vision.
V'achush ha-chamishi, and the fifth sense, hu chush ha-shema. That's the power, the audio power, the power to hear.
Like the eye, there need be no physical contact between the source of the sound and the hearer.
But the sound you can hear even through mechitzas.
Even if there are interruptions, one can still hear. One can hear things that one cannot see. And you don't need any external source of energy. You don't need light. You can hear in the dark. You can hear even if there are mechitzas. Somebody can be standing in another room where you cannot see the person, but you can hear. It can be dark. You cannot see the person, not only because there's a wall in between, but also because there is no light. But that doesn't interfere at all with one's ability to hear. That is the power of vision. That is the power of the ear of hearing. So vision has the power of long distance, and hearing has the power of unlimited. It is not governed by the same limitations that govern the other senses. Hearing is a more free sense than vision is.
There is another element to vision and hearing, and that is that vision is superficial. One can only see the surface. One cannot see beneath the surface. Whereas hearing, one can hear from right inside. One doesn't just hear the surface. The sound is produced by the quality of the object through and through. It's not just a surface sound.
Whereas vision is only on the surface. However, vision has the maila, that it has clarity. When one hears, there is place for interpretation. It's not always absolutely clear what one is hearing. There is an opportunity for interpretation, whereas vision is clarity. There's no opportunity for interpretation. You see something, you see it. As Chazal say, "Ein odoyim shmiya l'ri'ya." When it comes to clarity, you cannot compare the audio to the visual. Visual is, has far greater clarity than the audio has, but the audio has more depth and it has more more insight to it than the visual has. And perhaps as a result of that, there is a further difference between the visual and the audio, and that is that the visual does not involve the intellectual process as the audio does. And this really is what underlies the difference in the definition between the audio and the visual. That whereas the audio requires interpretation and therefore needs to be thought out, needs to be interpreted, needs to be analyzed, you can't just respond to it on the basis of its superficiality. Vision does not have to be sorted out. And here we have to the two major areas of appreciating the Bria. We learnt in the Vilna Gaon this afternoon that Shehakol Boro Lichvoido, that everything in the Bria, everything in the world, the Ribbono Shel Olam created for his own Kovod, we must be able to achieve greater appreciation of the wonders of the Ribbono Shel Olam, of the honor of God, through our perception of the world around us. And there are two methods we use to perceive the world around us. The one is the intellectual. We analyze. The other is the aesthetic. And aesthetics requires a direct response. Aesthetics, you spoil aesthetics when you start analyzing too much. Aesthetics must be able to address a person directly without analysis. If you stand and you look at a beautiful painting and you have to analyze why it's beautiful, then it's not beautiful. It's got to be a beautiful painting means you look at it and you say, goodness, this is beautiful. Afterwards you can analyze what it means and its message and all sorts of things. But there must be an immediate response of beauty. One can go outside and look at the stars in the heavens and see that the sky full of stars and just be amazed immediately. Beautiful. That's aesthetics. That's the visual. And then one can start thinking. Distances, relationships one to the other, movements, effect on one another, gravitational forces. And then one starts, as one starts rationalizing and thinking, one achieves even more wonder of the Ribbono Shel Olam, but that's following a different route. That's following not the direct aesthetic response, but the more indirect, however deeper, intellectual response. And we need to be able to operate with those two all the time. One needs to be able to open oneself to a direct and an immediate response to beauty, and one needs also to be able to analyze and think a thing through in order to perceive its depth. One needs to use vision. Vision is aesthetics. To look and say, I see. And that seeing, the mere act of vision, brings one to wonderment. And shemiyah means, I hear, I have analyzed, I have understood, I have penetrated the deeper meaning of that which I have sensed. And I am able to appreciate the meaning. Shemiyah is a value. Shemiyah requires a value system. Shemiyah requires intellect. Shemiyah requires the brain. It requires analysis. Re'iyah doesn't. I mentioned last night to a few people privately and again this morning in the ladies' share, and I'll say it again now. Television is re'iyah. Television is not shemiyah. Television doesn't allow, or very seldom does it allow, for analysis, for reasoning. It's only direct response. And therefore, one has to appreciate too that the aesthetics is alright, but it's not long-lasting. You can look at the stars and you can say, wow, that's amazing. But how long can you look at them for without actually entering into an analysis and an appreciation of it? One can look at a painting and say, that's beautiful, but how long can you stand in front of the painting before you start analyzing it and before you start reasoning with it? There cannot be any kind of long-term appreciation of something which one isn't relating to with Shmi, or something one isn't hearing, something one isn't endeavoring to understand and to analyze. If it is only an immediate response, then that response is immediate, but it's not long-lasting. And so it is with something like television that one has to be so careful about, to use it only sparingly and only selectively, because it involves the mind in passivity. It involves the mind in being totally passive, which is Re'iyah. In Re'iyah, when one sees, the mind is not occupied. That's a direct response to the eyes. One is able to respond to beauty. There's no thinking. There's no activity involved at all. That's something which is totally passive. One needs to be able to do it. That's part of the richness of the Bria, is appreciated through one's direct perception. But that's not sufficient. That's not where it can end.
With that understanding, we can begin to appreciate Esav and his relationship to Yitzchok a little bit better. Esav, there's some interesting things said about the two of them. The one is on the name of Esav. The first thing, I think the Klei Yoker points out, that when it talks about the naming of Esav, it says, Vayikru'u shmoi Esav. They called his name Esav. Who's they? Says the Klei Yoker, everybody. It was obvious that that was going to be his name. It was so clear on the surface. He was named by his appearance. He was named for things external. Esav, he was completely made. He was a finished baby. He had all his hair. He looked like a miniature human being, completely finished. Which also indicated, says the Klei Yoker, that his involvement in the world was going to be in the Olam Hazeh, in the place of immediate gratification. When a child's born, it has all its five senses. And they don't become that much more sophisticated as the person grows older. On the contrary, if anything, the senses deteriorate as the person grows older. But when it comes to the intellect, when it comes to the power of perception, that becomes sharper and sharper as the person grows older. Yaakov comes from Akev, something which is going to take place in the future, something which is a preparation for something which will take place in the future, says the Klei Yoker. Esav worked on immediate results, on immediate gratification. He works on Olam Hazeh. Yaakov works on cause and effect. And cause and effect is he wasn't born complete. Esav was born with complete, meaning that his essence was his senses, and his senses were complete. Yaakov's essence was his mind, was his intellect and his soul, and that wasn't complete at all. That still took a long time to develop. Yaakov was a late developer, and therefore his name was Yaakov. And by Yaakov, it doesn't say they called him Esav. That you needed Chochmah to perceive that that was the essence of Yaakov. Vayikro shmo Yaakov. And he called his name Yaakov. Some say it was Yitzchok who called him Yaakov. Some say it was the Ribbono Shel Olam who called him Yaakov. But there it's in the singular. They called him Esav. Everybody called him Esav. That was a name given to him by society. Because society could relate to the essence of Esav. Society can relate to what they see. There you don't have uniqueness. There you don't have individuality because everybody sees the same. But Yaakov was named after his essence. For that you need to hear, to understand, to have a good perception as to what Yaakov really was. That's Vayikra. That only singular people could appreciate the essence of Yaakov. So we see already from birth a different method of operating. Yaakov operating in Olam Habo, the long-term cause and effect. Yaakov operating with understanding, with intellect, with analysis. Esav operating with the senses, with external appearance, with presentation. Then the story goes on. And we see it again when Esav comes to Yaakov, tired from killing Nimrod in the field, and he asks, what does he ask for? Ha'adoyim ha'adoyim hazeh, give me some of this red stuff. Says the Sipurnu, and they called him Edoim. As a result of that, they called him the red one. Such superficial names, because he called it red stuff, they call him Edoim. We're talking about colors. Colors is perception. Colors is aesthetics. His original name Esav was given to him because of his appearance. He appeared complete. His second name, Edom, was a color. Why? Because he called the food Edom. And why is that so significant, says the Sipurnu? Kisheru, when people saw Shekol kach ismachel im lachtoy aniseres, asheloi kiseres ha'odom, that he was so involved in his work to the extent which is inhuman. Ad sheloi hikir benozid ki im tzivoy, until the only way he had of perceiving and identifying the food was by its color. He couldn't call it a name. He couldn't call it by its essence. That Esav himself related to the world around him by its appearance, by its most superficial appearance. Therefore, Koro Shemoi Edom Loshun Sivri. Therefore, they called him Edom in the imperative. Kloima his Adim veYet Savua Odom Belatos Odom. Paint yourself red with the drinking of the red stuff. Be red. Paint yourself red. Go red. The whole thing is superficiality right through. So we begin to see Esav as the master of appearance. And Esav and Yaakov as the master of content. Now, there's not a long distance between mastering appearance and mastering illusions, because illusion is simply the presentation of things in a way where you see them only on the surface, where you don't see what's really happening. Illusion, you see.
It's all there for you to see, but you don't understand it. If you would understand it, then you wouldn't see what you see. The reason that you're conned is because you don't understand what you see.
And there's not a long way between this illusion and this and appearance. Rav Dessler goes much further and says that superficiality and sheker, superficiality and deceit, superficiality and dishonesty, sheker, opposite of emes, are the same.
That there's no such thing as saying, I understand this superficially. If it's superficial, you don't understand it. On the contrary, you fooled yourself. You think you understand it, but you don't. Because there is nothing which is what it looks like. In Olam Hazeh. In Olam Habo, that's something else. In the Ribbono Shel Olam's world, everything is precisely what it looks like. There is no gap between appearance and reality. But the essence of Olam Hazeh, says Rav Dessler, is that Olam Hazeh is never what it appears to be. And if you see it only on the surface, you are seeing incorrectly. You are wrong. You are fooling yourself. That's why we were saying the learning, there's no such thing as saying, let's learn a Hebekiyas, let's go superficially. There's no such thing as learning superficially. Superficially means you're misleading yourself. It cannot be, there's nothing that you can see superficially and really understand and really know. Yes, aesthetic appearance, that yes, aesthetics is not understanding, aesthetics is not knowing, aesthetics is responding to a certain sense of color and a sense of proportion and a sense of relationship with one another, a sense of balance, that one can respond to superficially. Aesthetics is a superficial sense. But that's not understanding, that's not knowledge. There is no such thing as superficial understanding or superficial knowledge. Because superficiality, shidchiyus, says Rav Dessler, is sheker, is deceit. There cannot be anything else.
And he says that's why the Midrash says that Esav's world was Olam Hazeh. Esav could not operate in a world where things are what they appear to be, and they appear to be what they are.
The illusionist thrives in Olam Hazeh. He can't operate in Olam Habo. He thrives on the discrepancy between things as they really are and things as they appear to be. That's his mastery. That's his koach. That's where he lives. That's where he operates. And in everything that we do, there are these two factors all the time. Things as they appear and things as they are. And the successful people in Olam Hazeh, talking exclusively about Olam Hazeh, the successful people in Olam Hazeh are people who know how to master things as they appear to be. What they are is irrelevant. That doesn't make any difference as far as purely Olam Hazeh success is concerned. If we take morality out, if we take value systems out, if we just look at pure material success, the road to success is mastery of illusion, is mastery of appearance. There is nothing else to it.
That was Esav. So Chazal tell us that Esav used to ask his father all sorts of interesting shailas. He appeared very frum. Esav was able to dress himself up in a way and to act
in a way which portrayed and projected absolute Yiras Shamayim. Esav did not appear to be an ordinary person. Esav did not appear. Appearances we talk about. He was a master of illusion, don't forget. He was a master of appearance. He knew body language. He knew how to project himself. He was an actor of a superb quality. And he knew how to be convincing in every act that he did. And he acted the part of a very serious Yorei Shamayim. Of somebody God-fearing at every step. He acted that part to the full.
How did Yitzchak fall for it? There is a hint in the parasha where it says, introducing the episode of the brachas,
"Vayehi ki zokein Yitzchak vatichoheno einov mirois," and it was when Yitzchak was old and his eyes became weak and unable to see. By Yikro es Esav Gunai Agodol, that he called Esav his oldest son and told him to come to him.
Says Rashi in one of his Perushim, why did his eyes become weak that he couldn't see? Kedei sheyitul Yaakov es habrochus, so that Yaakov could get the brochus. What does that imply?
That as long as Yitzchok was using his power of vision, Esav would get the brochus. What does that mean? That Yitzchok used vision, and from the point of view of vision, Esav looked the better one. Or according to the Sipurim, Esav at least looked pretty good, not as good as Yaakov. Or maybe even not according to the Sipurim, Esav at least appeared to have the potential. Maybe Yaakov had more depth, and of course Yitzchok could perceive that, all sorts of things. But it could be that using perception, Esav came across, using visual perception, Esav came across with the most potential. And we know that in fact Esav did have potential, that Yaakov was criticized for not marrying Dinah off to Esav, because Chazal say Dinah could have turned Esav around. Esav could have become a tzaddik. And Yitzchok perceived that tzidkus in Esav, or that potential tzidkus in Esav, the potential for righteousness in Esav. But what faculty was he using? Says Rashi, he was using vision. And his vision had to go before Yaakov could get the brochus. To appreciate Yaakov, to appreciate Yaakov in the relationship between Yaakov and Esav, vision had to become weaker. Imagine a blind person appreciating David Copperfield. I don't mean Charles Dickens as David Copperfield. The other one. Imagine a blind person. How can you appreciate David Copperfield if you're blind? The better your sight is, the more you appreciate. If you haven't got clear sight, then you'll say, obviously I missed something. That's why I obviously didn't see clearly, it's because I can't see. To really appreciate him, you need sharp vision. And the sharper the vision, the more you appreciate him. So it was with Esav. The sharper Yitzchok's vision, the more Esav comes out on top, because he's a master of illusion. It was necessary for Yitzchok's vision to become impaired before Yaakov could come into his own. And perhaps that's what the Torah means when it says that Yitzchok loved Yaakov, kitzayid b'fiv. Yitzchok loved Esav, kitzayid b'fiv. Yitzchok loved Esav because, as we read, game was in his mouth. And our question was, game was in whose mouth? And let's take both of them together. Let us take Unculus and Targum Yoyinuson. He liked him because game, the art of deceit, was in the mouth of Esav. But surely Yitzchok wouldn't fall for the deceit. But Sayid Befiv. What does Unculus say? What does it mean that there was game in his mouth? Says Unculus, Are mitzide hava ochil, because it was from his game that Yitzchok ate. Unculus stresses by the order of the words, not that he loved him because he ate his game, because he liked the taste, because it was Esav's which he ate. There's a chorus atoiv. I've been eating, I am the beneficiary of Esav. And here we come to the very essence, the core of deceit. A con man needs two factors to be successful. He must be a master of illusion. He must be able to project himself to be what he isn't. He must be able to project honesty, even though he's deceitful. He must be able to project competence, even though he's incompetent. He must be able to project knowledge, even though he's unknowledgeable. But he needs to do something else at the same time. People can see through conmanship. The only time you can't see conmanship if it is combined with flattery. And the conman will always flatter simultaneously. He has to use the two together. Because when you are the beneficiary of somebody else, you refuse to look any deeper than the surface. You view him only on the surface. That's the way you choose to see him. That's the way you want to see him. And once he's got you looking only at the surface, then using his mastery of illusion and using his mastery of projection, he can make you think what you want. Again, come back to David Copperfield. His godless lies not only in his mastery of illusion, but in his engaging personality. He's an entertainer too. He's a communicator. He puts you at your ease, he makes you feel good, he relaxes you. And then he starts with the illusion. And you are taken absolutely. And so it is with any con man. The first thing he does is, he uses his power of charm, not only his power of deceit.
If a con man used his power of deceit only, he wouldn't succeed in conning any intelligent person. He must use flattery, he must use every possible form of entertainment apart from his deceitfulness.
You'll find that in business, if you analyze, find out the story, anybody who's been conned. It's a wonderful study. Take somebody who's been conned, and Kenan and Hora, there's no shortage of such people, and ask them, how did it happen? And the first answer you'll get is, I don't know. I just don't know. And you'll say, come, let's go back to the beginning. How did it happen in the beginning? In the beginning, I've got a customer, an ex-customer, who's a master con man. He is so deceitful, you cannot imagine. And he's known to be deceitful all over the world. The entire world knows him. Anybody who's in the industry, in any country in the world, knows him to be deceitful. Yet he does the most wonderful business. And he's getting wealthier and wealthier, and he's building up an empire. And it's an absolute amazement to behold. How does it happen? Go overseas, you go to, and you meet suppliers from all sorts of countries, and they say, oh, you're from South Africa, do you know so-and-so? And you say, yes, and you know what's coming. And they say, tell me. And they talk to you in this confidential undertone. How do I get my payment from him? How can I get him to pay me? And you shake your head and you wander off to the next place. And the same, everybody knows the man. And he goes on and on and on. So eventually I found somebody who'd been conned most recently by this person for a large amount of money. And this is an intelligent person. And I said to him, how does it happen? He said, don't you know? I said, no. He said, this person is unbelievable. He doesn't just con you. If he sells you a stone worth, or he sells you a stone for 500,000 rand, you must know that the stone is not worth more than 50,000 rand. The question is, how does he get intelligent people to pay 500,000 rand for something that's worth 50,000 rand? He says, he meets you in South Africa. He sells mainly to tourists. And he meets them here, but he doesn't sell to them when they're here. He takes them out for dinner, entertains them a little bit, and merely drops in the conversation that he's in that line of business. But there's no suggestion that he's open to business. This is purely social. It's weeks and months and sometimes years later that the foreign party will get a telephone call saying, I have something that I want you to see. My private jet will be in your city tomorrow morning. I'll bring you out. It's Friday. It's the weekend. You'll spend the weekend with me. I'll have you back in your office on Monday morning. You've got to see this thing that I have. And what a weekend does this person get? An expensive weekend, but he pays for it many, many times over at the end of it. That's how he sells. The actual stone which he shows, that's a small part of it. The deceit alone would never convince intelligent people that they're to do what they land up doing. It has to be combined with flattery. It has to be combined with entertainment. It has to be combined with the whole social scene. Why is it that in business throughout the Western world, not only the Western world, the Eastern world even more perhaps, the social side is so important? Why should the social side be important in business? I have an article to sell. You require the article. We will sit down and negotiate a price and agree, and you will take the article home and I'll go home and we never have to see each other again. Why is the whole social scene so important? Because we're dealing in Olam Hazeh, not in Olam Haba. And a large percentage of business, unfortunately, is based on what things appear to be and not what things really are. If people were buying what things really are, then perhaps the social side would not be that important. As it isn't when it comes to matters of essentials. When a lady needs to buy her groceries, she goes to the supermarket and she buys her groceries and she comes home. She doesn't get a private invitation from the owner of the supermarket to come out to dinner with him that evening. It's not necessary. That's a plain and simple thing. She shops around, she goes where it's cheapest or most convenient, she makes a purchase and she goes home. But the moment one comes onto more sophisticated business where things are not what they appear to be, business could not function without the social side. And Chazal tell us, Yitzchok was drawn into a social relationship with Esav. Ki tzayid befiv. Esav used to entertain his father lavishly. And what did that cause? Not that Esav couldn't see properly. Not that Yitzchok couldn't see properly. You could see very well, but only see. And if we relate to people only with our eyes, we miss what lies beneath the surface.
Now, of course, Yitzchok, with his Ruach HaKodesh and with his Nevuah, with his prophecy and his brilliance of intellect and his sanctity, surely he would have been able to raise himself above that. To which we have two answers. Firstly, there might be a limud here, that there is no human being capable of raising himself above that. That is part of the essence of humanity, that we do fall for it. As Chazal in fact tell us, as the Torah in fact tells us, that even wise people in the Torah's measure of wisdom become blinded by bribery, become blinded by corruption. There is no such thing as a person being able to remove himself totally from that kind of effect. But even if we go further and say, no, there is, Torah is talking, generally people can't, but a person like Yitzchok, of course he could elevate himself above it. But as we mentioned at the outset, for some reason the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted this episode to take place by use of this apparent deceit on the part of Yaakov. And the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted Yitzchok to operate like an ordinary man in this area. The Ribbono Shel Olam organized it so that Yitzchok would operate like an ordinary man here, not like an Av with Ruach HaKodesh, not like one of our forefathers with Ruach HaKodesh and with Kedusha and Nevuah and all sorts of things that should have elevated him. The Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say, withdrew that special protection and let him function like a regular human being. As wise as he is, a Chochem, yes, but a Chochem will fall for it too. He'll see everything. And the Chochem will say, the man who's been conned will say, I saw everything. This man couldn't put anything behind me. And when he came with his contract, I went through it with a fine-tooth comb. Nothing escaped me. And yet he got the better of me. How come? You saw everything, but the shmir was missing. The analysis, what lies beneath the surface, you saw only what he wanted you to see. He knew you would go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and he knew while you were negotiating and arguing about crossing the T's and dotting the I's, he would be able to do all sorts of things that you weren't listening for. That was all part of the plan. He knows you're a chochom, he knows you won't miss a thing, but he knows that if he's entertaining you lavishly, you will be using only your eyes. And that's all that's necessary. Once you're using only your eyes, then you can pull wool over people's ears.
And that might be what the Chumash is telling us. That Yaakov, Tzayid Befiv, both are right. Esav, Tzayid Befiv. There was the art of deceit in his mouth. But why did it work? Because Tzayid Befiv. Because Yitzchok ate from Esav's food, because Yitzchok was entertained over and over again by Esav, that's why the deceit worked. Had either factor not been there, it wouldn't have occurred. Had there not been deceit, Yitzchok would not have been taken in by the flattery and by the entertainment. Had there been entertainment without deceit, Yitzchok would not have been taken in by that. There had to be the two together, the deceit and the entertainment together, caused even Yitzchok to falter in his judgment of Esav. And that helps us understand a kasha of the Ramban, or rather the answer to a kasha of the Ramban in a very interesting way. The Ramban asks a very simple question. Yitzchok's mother, Yaakov's mother, tells him, I've heard, note, not seen, I've heard what your father told Esau, and you now listen to me, shma b'keli, listen to me. And Chazal say this is all with Ruach HaKodesh. And she says, you'll put skins on your hand, you'll feel like Esau, and off you'll go. And you'll present yourself to your father. Yaakov is very worried about this. And he says, Ulai yemusheni ovi v'hayisi b'enov kimesateya. Perhaps my father will touch me, he'll feel me. And I will be like a deceitful person in his eyes. I will be like somebody misleading him. Asks the Ramban, you worried that he might touch you? Maybe he will, maybe he won't. But one thing for sure, he's going to hear your voice. Why aren't you worried he'll recognize your voice? As Yaakov does in the end. As Yitzchok does in the end. You're going to speak, you're going to say something to him. Surely that's what you should have been worried about. If there's a flaw in the plan, surely the flaw is in the voice? Answers the Ramban, so we must say they had very similar voices. Or that Yaakov knew how to imitate Esau's voice in such a way that he felt confident that he could come over in a way that his father would not sense the difference. But that Ramban is very difficult for the following reason. When Yaakov does present himself, his father asks straight away, who are you? Why does he ask who are you? Because he's not sure.
Why is he not sure? He says, Geshono v'amushcho, as Yaakov feared. The father says, Yitzchak says, come here, let me touch you, let me feel you. Why? What's the cause of doubt? Yitzchak asks Esav to go out and bring him food. A little while later, apparently Esav comes back. His mastery of voice alteration is such, of mimicry is such, that it sounds just like Esav. What is it that causes his father to figure out there's something wrong? Says Rashi, Omar Yitzchak b'libo ein derech Esav li yeshem shemayim shogur b'fiv. Esav doesn't use the Ribbono Shel Olam's name in day-to-day conversation. V'zeh Omar ki hikru Hashem elokecha? When I asked him, why were you so quick, he said, I had siyata d'shmaya today. Says Yitzchak, that doesn't sound like Esav. Now what kind of a fool is Yaakov? All this trouble he goes to. He puts on the skins around his arms in case his father touches him. He alters his voice, says the Ramban, that he should sound like Esav. Everything he does. And he slips up on such a basic flaw as this. Any spy knows that. You don't say Baruch Hashem and Emir Hashem if you're trying to imitate Esav. His voice you imitate. But the style of speaking, you speak like a Rosh Hashiva.
And his father in fact responds, Hakol Kol Yaakov, this is the voice of Yaakov, says Rashi also.
It's not that the sound of the voice was like Yaakov, that Yaakov knew how to disguise, or they sounded the same. When his father says, Hakol Kol Yaakov, this is the voice of Yaakov, Shemedaber Beloshin Tachanunim, this is a Yaakov talking. He says, please, he says, thank you, he talks respectfully, Kumno, please get up. Aval Esav Beloshin Kanturia, Yokumavi, but Esav doesn't talk like that, he talks aggressively. This isn't an aggressive man. So why did Yaakov not disguise the softness in his voice, the politeness? Why didn't he talk a bit aggressively, do the act properly?
You have to say that Yaakov did not fear that Yitzchok would notice the difference. Why not? How's that possible? Because, says Yaakov to himself, if my father has been judging us using the power of Shmiyo, using his ears,
he would have noticed the difference between us a long time ago. He wouldn't have been a supporter of Esav. If he would have used his ears, he would have noticed the aggression in Esav. He would have noticed the harshness in Esav, the lack of respect. He would have seen the steer of the conflict, that when he talks to you, to his own father, he doesn't say Yokum no, he doesn't say please, he doesn't say thank you. It's aggressive. But Esav is the big Mechabed Av, he's the one who's so outstanding in his honoring of father and mother. If you listen deeply, you notice that's not genuine. If you listen to the style, you notice that there's a lack of kovod. So why did Yitzchok never notice that? Says Yaakov to himself, because my father used his eyes, not his ears. I can talk like I've talked all these years. I don't have to change the content of my speech. Because if I did have to change the content of my speech, my father wouldn't have made the mistake in the first place. All I have to worry about is that I look like Esav and that I feel like Esav in case he touches me. That's all I have to worry about, that I smell like Esav. But that I sound like Esav, that my father has never used his powers of audio, his audio powers, his powers of hearing, to determine who's right, who's the greater tzaddik, Yaakov or Esav. And so he goes in with confidence, and he talks like he's always talked before, carefully, correctly, careful to say only that which he really has to say, if it's a little bit off-center as far as the truth is concerned. Careful to say Baruch Hashem and Yitzah Hashem, and using all the terminology that he always used, careful to be polite in his speech, with no attempt even to imitate Esav in depth. He imitates Esav only on the surface, but not on depth. And we understand the reason for that too. Bad enough, and one can imagine how distasteful it was for Yaakov to present himself as Esav, even just for a few minutes, but to still present his inside as Esav, that would have been totally intolerable to him, and he felt it wasn't necessary. But the fact is, Yitzchak does pick it up. The fact is, Yitzchak does notice there's something wrong. And what is it he notices wrong? He's talking like a Rosh Hashiva, he's not talking like Esav. Does that mean Yitzchak had seen all along this difference? Maybe yes, but possibly no. There's been a change in Yitzchak, as we commented before. And the change is, Vatichoheno Einov Mirois. Yitzchok's power of vision has become impaired. He doesn't see with the same clarity. What happens to a person whose one sense becomes weakened? If a person's power of vision becomes weakened, what happens? His power of hearing becomes sharper.
If a person's hearing becomes impaired, his power of vision becomes sharper. He lip reads and he relies on his eyes far more. As one sense becomes weaker, so the others take over and become stronger. When Yitzchok became older and his vision started waning, his ears, his audial ability had to start strengthening. And it was then that Yitzchok for the first time realizes this conflict. This man who's talking to me, he feels like Esav, he looks like Esav as far as I can see. On the surface, everything's Esav. But there's something deep inside that this man is no Esav. This is Hakol Kol Yaakov.
And that was necessary in order for the brokers to come to Yaakov. You might ask why. If Yitzchok didn't perceive that unique sound in Yaakov's voice, what then?
Then he would really have thought it was Esav, and he would have given him a good brocha. But it would have been a brocha given to a man whom Yitzchok thought was Esav. Now the brocha was given to a man who Yitzchok felt at least had the internal capacity of Yaakov. Whether he knew it was Yaakov or he didn't know it was Yaakov, whatever the case is, one thing is clear, he was addressing a person who had the kol Yaakov. He gave these brochas to a person who was polite, to a person who was sensitive, to a person who was refined, to a person who was
spiritual even in his manner of talk, not only in the content of his talk. And for that Yaakov, for the brocha to be given knowingly to somebody of the capacity of Yaakov, there had to be this deterioration in the vision of Yitzchok. Otherwise, he himself would not have perceived fully to whom he was giving the brochas. And right at the end of the Sedra, we see this difference between Yaakov and Esav expressing itself again very clearly. And almost as if the parasha finally draws our attention to it, that you should see exactly what the difference is. Yitzchok instructs Yaakov to go and marry a girl from Padan Aram, not to marry a girl from Canaan. Vayar Esav ki veirach Yitzchok is Yaakov. And Esav saw with his eyes that Yitzchok had blessed Yaakov and that he'd sent him to Padan Aram to marry a wife from there when he blessed him, saying to him, you shall not marry a wife from Canaan. So Esav also, what does it say? Vayar Esav. And Esav saw, perceived with his eyes superficially, he rose b'nos Canaan, that Yaakov, that Yitzchok doesn't like the girls from Canaan. Vayelech Esav and Yishmael, so Esav goes to Yishmael. And last night we learned the Chazals who were so critical of Esav in doing that. That he didn't really understand. That's not what his father wanted. His father wanted them to go dafke to his mother's family. Esav misread his father. How is it possible that a man so tuned into his father should misread such a simple instruction? Because twice the Torah tells us, Vayar Esav, twice, Esav was using his superficial powers of perception. He didn't listen to the words. He listened only to what was being said on the surface. But what about Yaakov? Vayishma Yaakov el oviv el imo vayelech padeno aro. Yaakov understood his mother and father, and he went to Padan Aram. He used his powers of hearing, of analysis, of understanding, not just his powers of vision, not just the superficial. Yaakov understood, Yaakov heard, Esav saw.
Here at the end of the parasha where they separate and go their different ways, we see once again each one using such different methods of interpreting the world around him. Yaakov, Esav using the superficial vision, looking at things as they appear to be, and Yaakov using the powers of intellect, of analysis, to perceive things as they really are, not merely as they appear to be. These two powers of Shemio and Re'ia, of listening, of hearing and seeing, are both powers needed very much in Avodas Hashem.
Rabbeinu Yonah brings the pasuk from Mishlei that we had in the Shabbos afternoon shiur only a week or two ago, where it says, Ma'ir Einayim Yitzamach Lev, the light of the eyes, visual perception, gladdens the heart. That's aesthetic appearance. That's the purpose of vision, is to be able to see beautiful things, to be able to respond to the beauty of the world. Shemua Tova, but good hearing, to hear something good, to understand something else. Tadashin Etzim, That refreshes the bones. That goes right inside. And that strengthens the person from within. That has a different quality. Shmua Toiva is a different quality. Says Rabbeinu Yoina, ulefi kavonos ha'echochom b'sefer hazeh.
What is the purpose of the book of Proverbs of Sefer Mishlei? What was it written for? We're told right in the first lines of the Sefer. Shehiladas chochmo musa. The purpose is to know wisdom and ethics. Chochmo musa. Once you know the purpose of the Sefer, now you can analyze the meaning of this verse, says Rabbeinu Yoina. Yiyeh perush ha'posuk hazeh, and the meaning of this posuk means, shebo lahari chuliyaches chushei hodom zeh lezeh, that it comes to comment on the relationship of the senses one to another. Ulahakir ulahavchin, and to recognize and to discern. Lahakir is with the eyes. Lahavchin is with the mind. Al yedei ha'erech hazeh, eizeh chush nichbad mikulum la'avedis Hashem boi. Which is the most important sense to use in Avodas Hashem? The Nosan Ho'erech Ben Shnei HaChushim HaNichbodim. And Mishle says that the two senses needed most importantly in the service of God are vision and hearing. Ma'ir Einayim and Shmua Toivo. Those are essential properties, essential senses in the service of Hashem, each in its own way, in its own capacity. Now it's interesting that when we talk of Yirah Shemayim, of being God-fearing, Yirah and everything that goes with it, what does the word Yirah mean? Visual, to see. And when the Torah talks about the Chiyuv to learn Torah, to study, it talks about Shemir. The brother of the Vilna Gaon in his Sefer Malas HaTorah counts that there are 52 mitzvahs d'oraisa, 52 positive injunctions of the Torah that instruct a person to learn Torah. And he counts many of them. He doesn't record them all. He records many of them. And they're all written Beloshun Shmir. It doesn't say that often, you shall learn. It says, you shall hear. And he brings Shema B'Kilo. When Avrom is told, listen to her voice. V'amru Chazal l'kol Ruach HaKodesh b'shibo. When she talks with Ruach HaKodesh, you're obligated to listen to understand it. As you're obligated to listen and understand the Torah. Ekev asher shoma Avrom b'keili in our Sedra today, because Avrom listened to me, says the brother of the Vilna Gaon, that's one of the mitzvahs that you've got to learn Torah. Asher, you see that the shmio, listening, in shemayitz v'shomu l'keilecho, v'yamein hom v'yishmu, im shamaya tishmu l'keil Hashem, im shamaya tishmu b'keili, over and over again, im shamaya tishmu b'keiloi, over and over again, if you shall surely listen. That's the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, to use one's powers of analysis, to use one's intellect to understand, to hear what lies beneath the surface. Talmud Torah doesn't mean to read the surface. That's real, that's reading. And we're told over and over again to learn Torah with the power of Shmir, to listen, to hear. So the two foundations of our religious involvement, Yirah Shamayim is the visual, and Talmud Torah, the learning of Torah, is the audio. That has to be done with the intellect. There has to be both. But we can go a step further and we can say that even in Yirah Shamayim, the two have to go together. You remember in the Shabbos afternoon shiur, the Vilna Gaon asked how to understand the difficult Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Imein Yirah, Imein Chochmah. If there is no wisdom, there is no God-fearing. If there is no God-fearing, there is no wisdom. Asked the Vilna Gaon, so where do you start? If you don't have the one, you haven't got the other. If you don't have the other, you don't have the one, so where do you start? So he said, you'll remember, there are two kinds of Yirah Shamayim. There is Yirah Shamayim, Yirah Sa'inesh, and there is Yirah Shamayim, Yirah Sa'inemus. When we talk of the fear of God, we really mean two different things. We mean fear of God and awe of God. To hold God in fear, that means I am aware of consequences. It doesn't mean that I go around always in a state of terror and in a state of black depression and neurosis. It means that I'm aware of consequences. Yirah Shamayim, I know that I will be held accountable for everything I say and for everything I do. That's Yirah Shamayim. And the Ribbono Shel'olam rewards and the Ribbono Shel'olam punishes. That's the basis of Yirah Shamayim. I have to know that and I have to operate with that awareness in my mind. Is that seeing or is that hearing? There's nothing to understand about that. That's visual. You have to perceive in front of you the enormity of consequence. One has to see in front of you in a superficial way. You don't need depth for that. You just need to know that for every action there is a reaction. For everything that you do, there is an accountability, and that the Ribbono Shel Olam rewards and punishes. That's primitive. That's basic. That's the starting point. A child, a baby, is able to understand cause and effect. consequence of action. An animal is able to understand it. When you get the puppy into your house and he makes a mess and you smack the puppy and he does it again and you smack him again, eventually he stops doing it. Why? Because he understands you don't want it? No. Just because he begins to connect the two together. I make a mess, it hurts. I don't want to be sore, stop making a mess, that's all. That it's animal, it's so primitive. Yirah Shamayim in its lowest level, in its level of Yirah Sa'inish, of fearing consequence, is an animal fear, that's all it is. That's visual, it's not audio, there's no analysis, there's no intellect involved. Yirah Sa'inimus, to appreciate the Ribbono Shel Olam's elevation, to appreciate his greatness, to appreciate his enormity. For that there needs to be a bit of perception. For that there needs to be understanding, appreciation, analysis. Different thing altogether. That's Yiras HaRimimus. That's already with the visual. That's already with the audio. So even in Yiro itself, not only is the study of Torah, does the study of Torah need the application of the audio sense, of the active participation, of analysis, of thinking. But even Yiras Shamayim, even in the fear of God, even in the area of being God-fearing in the broader sense, of Yiras Shamayim, of being ethical, of being concerned with consequence, there too, it's true one starts with the superficial appearance of things. But very soon one has to come even in that field into Shemiyah. And the brother of the Vilna Gaon concludes the section by saying that just as you need Yiro, as you need visual in Yiras Shamayim, so you need to hear V'hakol Tolui Bishmiyah. This is the brother of the Vilna Gaon, and in the final analysis, everything depends on hearing. And again, Shmiyah, as we see throughout the Torah, means understanding, analysis, depth, principles. Ulefichach, and that is the reason, he says, Ona mevorachim lishmoya kol shoifa v'loy liskoya shoifa. On Rosh Hashanah, we make the brocha to hear the sound of the shofar. Very unusual brocha. Always we make the brocha on the action. Al natilas yodayim, we make a brocha for wiping the hands. We make a brocha for all the things that we do, lahaniach tefillin, to put the tefillin on. Al mitzvah tzitzis, lhisatef betzitzis. There's always the action of the mitzvah is always mentioned in the brocha. Here, it's not blowing the shofar which is mentioned in the brocha. It's the shmeya kol shofar. Why? Lefi sha'ashofar bo liyorei ulahacharidoisom. Because the shofar comes to make us fear and tremble. So I might think, but fearing and trembling, that's visual, that's primitive. No, says the brother of the Vilna Gaon. Starts off primitive, but that's not the ultimate. Even in Yiro you have to come onto the understanding. That's where the true Yiro is. That's where the real depth of God-fearing lies, in analysis, in intellect, in understanding. And that's why in the Tchias HaShofar as well, you've got to listen to that sound, hear it, absorb it, understand what it's saying to you. It's got to speak to you. Not just see it, not just the sound is there and it makes you scared in a direct response sort of way. It doesn't. No Shofar blowing, what does it make you scared? But when one analyzes it and then one understands what the Shofar is, what those sounds mean, the difference of a Yelolo and a Yevova, a sobbing and a wailing, a Tekiyo and everything that the triumph of a Tekiyo means, the relationship between crying and triumph, starting with triumph, then the crying, then the triumph again. And one understands this and one hears intellectually what the Shofar is saying, then it's able to bring one to true Yiras Shamayim. That even in Yiras Shamayim, even in that which appears to be so visual and so superficial, there needs to be, in essence, also the Shmiyo, there needs to be the deep understanding. And so we find, as he ends off by saying, that the Ribbono Shel Olam has blessed us with many senses. We have the sense of touch, the most primitive of all. We have the sense of taste, a little less primitive. The sense of smell, beginning to become rather spiritual. And then we have the two supreme senses, the sense of vision with an almost infinite capacity to see to enormous distance with great clarity, but limited by the need to have nothing interrupting the line of vision and to have another source of energy. And then we have the source of sound, which says the Rabbeinu Yonah is the highest, the sense of sound, which is the highest of all, the sense of sound where one is able to hear. Even if there are interruptions, the line of vision does not have to be clear. One is able to hear sound
even without any other source of energy, merely using one's ear, one is able to hear. That is the greatest of all. And that Mishle, whose purpose it is to teach us methods of Chochma u'Musar, of wisdom and ethics, teaches us that the two most important senses in ethics and wisdom are seeing and hearing.
Seeing means immediate response, where the object acts on the subject. Shmio, where the subject acts on the object, where the subject interprets the object, where the subject analyzes the object, understands it and appreciates it. Those are the two that are most important of all. But at the end and the final analysis, as the brother of the Vilna Gaon, even in the area of ethics, Hakol Tolui Bishmiya, everything depends on our capacity to analyze, on our capacity to understand, and our ability to appreciate.